very first episode of this podcast, I tried to defend philosophy against its critics, who think science is all we need, philosophy is dead, and that it's all just pedantic navel-gazing. And this is a sort of sequel to that first episode. Defending philosophy is a fairly recent development in my life. I found a note in my phone from February 2018 that simply read, "Philosophy's greatest hits. Everything is water. There is no such thing as pain. The external world doesn't exist. Thermostats have beliefs. Consciousness doesn't exist." So it's not that I'm a lifelong philosophy nerd or that I've never been annoyed at philosophers. In that first episode, I complained about obscurantism in philosophy, including the smug pedantry of some who don't aim to teach or clarify, and the elitism of believing that philosophy isn't supposed to be for most people. There aren't philosophy communicators in the same way there are science communicators, and I think this is entirely the fault of philosophers, either because they make no serious effort to communicate to a popular audience, or worse, they think it's below them to try to communicate to a popular audience. Contrast that attitude with Socrates, who went among the people to do philosophy. I firmly believe philosophy is for everyone, to some degree. But what is the point of philosophy? It won't make you rich. It's not obviously useful like expertise in STEM fields is obviously useful. It's fairly common, upon asserting that philosophy doesn't completely suck, for someone to question the value of philosophy in one way or another. Common to all such questions and assertions is that they are themselves philosophical in nature. How is philosophy useful is a philosophical question. Everything that comes after a sentence that begins with, "All we need is science because ... is a philosophical argument. Everything that follows a sentence that begins with, "Philosophy is pointless because ... is also a philosophical argument. And it's probably a bad one considering the speaker doesn't like philosophy. In other words, anyone engaging in a debate challenging the value of philosophy has already lost. What matters, how we should live, what's worth doing and why are philosophical questions that we all have answers to, whether we recognize it or not. Those arguing that STEM fields are the only ones worth pursuing have answered those questions. They've implicitly accepted a narrow set of answers to questions like, what do I have the most reason to do? What matters? How should I live? One who scoffs and points out that you won't make any money studying philosophy has, whether they realize it or not, answered those questions. We all have answers to philosophical questions like, what's the meaning of my life? What's right and wrong? Everyone answers those questions with their actions every day. As David Egan puts it, a large part of philosophical training is to make those implicit answers explicit. All human lives feature some deliberation over what matters to us, what we like and dislike and why, what's meaningful, admirable or despicable, what's to be hoped for, what's to be feared. When we start asking these questions more deliberately and rigorously, we're intensifying an activity that's already familiar. End quote. As I said, I think philosophy is for everyone. It's something we do naturally. And Egan thinks this fact is at the root of the perceived softness of philosophy and the humanities generally, as opposed to the hard sciences. In a wonderful piece for Eon defending the value of philosophy, Egan draws an analogy between his own field and acting. Quote, "One of the most celebrated films of 2018 was Roma, a semi-autobiographical take on the director's own upbringing in Mexico City. The central figure, an indigenous maid named Cleo, was played by a first-time actor, to great acclaim, earning her an Academy Award nomination. And she's only one recent and prominent instance of a non-professional actor wowing audiences. The Italian neorealists in the post-war period made a virtue of working with non-professional actors. Directors such as Werner Herzog and Ken Loach have made significant use of them too. And a first-time actor won an Academy Award for his role in The Killing Fields in 1984. End quote. So it's possible for non-professional, first-time actors to deliver stunning performances. By contrast, Egan invites us to imagine a violin performance in which the violinist will be playing the instrument for the first time. To put it mildly, he says, this does not sound like a blueprint for artistic triumph. But the difference between acting and playing the violin is not that one is a soft science and the other is a hard science. There's no STEM humanities divide here. So why are there compelling performances from first-time actors, but no good performances from first-time violinists? Egan's answer is that, really, there is no such thing as a first-time actor. Every socialized human being has embodied knowledge of what it's like to fly into a rage, to explode with laughter, to eye someone with suspicion, to listen compassionately. These are all natural, universal human activities. Playing a violin is not, even though it's also artistic in nature and not a hard science. There is no embodied knowledge of how to play an instrument in the same way we have embodied knowledge of how to seem angry or contrite. Just like philosophy, acting takes universal human activities and focuses them in a more rigorous way. You're honing capacities that you already have to some degree. You're just getting better at something that you already do. Does this mean studying philosophy is pointless? Not any more than acting classes are pointless. Just because it's possible for first-time actors to give an incredible performance, and basically impossible for a first-time violinist, doesn't mean acting isn't a craft. You can be better or worse at acting, and you can be better or worse at philosophy. We're all philosophers. You might as well be a good one. Egan also points out that, quote, accolades for successful first-time performances emphasize authenticity or naturalness of actors, playing in roles fairly close to the ones they occupy off-screen. You wouldn't expect an untrained actor to excel in the role of an orc, a Victorian aristocrat, or a morose prince of Denmark. End quote. So while we regularly discern between truth and untruth, right and wrong, things that matter and things that don't, we could do a lot better for ourselves. Science and philosophy hold quite different positions in our culture. And as Bertrand Russell observed, this is in part because you don't need to know anything about science to enjoy the benefits of science, whereas the benefits of philosophy are only available to those who put in the work to understand it. The fruits of science are available to anyone, whether or not they know anything about the science behind their technology or medicine or what have you. The fruits of philosophy, however, are out of reach to anyone unwilling to learn about it. It would be like if you could only vaccinate yourself if you understood the science of vaccines. I think that the endemic disdain for philosophy in our culture today is in large part due to the success of science. This is not to disparage science. Philosophy and science are not in a zero-sum competition. They are not at odds in any way. That being said, the success of the empirical sciences has helped create a sort of default scientism in our culture. Science gives us the objective facts. Everything else is less than that. So why would you bother with anything else? Philip Goff has speculated that we're currently living in an era of history in which people are so blown away by the success of physical science and the technology it's produced that the average person, including the average academic, is inclined to think that science is capable of anything. There's no problem that it can't solve. Just look at its successes. In 1912, Bertrand Russell lamented that many men, under the influence of science or of practical affairs, are inclined to doubt whether philosophy is anything better than innocent but useless trifling, hair-splitting distinctions, and controversies on matters concerning which knowledge is impossible. End quote. The historical era in which we're living probably will come to be characterized by our relationship to science. Science is taken to be the ultimate authority, the gold standard, when it comes to truth. Even religious people implicitly accept this when they say things like, real science wouldn't contradict the Bible. They obviously engage in science denial, but they do it in such a way that acknowledges the authority of science. Everyone from young earth creationists to climate deniers accept the authority of science as where we get our truth from. Notice they don't say, who cares what science says about evolution or the climate? Rather, they make some variation of the claim, if it were real science, it wouldn't contradict the Bible. They believe there's something else at work that's distorting science, like anti-religious bias, or something material. That is quite different from simply rejecting the authority of science as a legitimate arbiter of truth. Climate deniers regularly claim that scientists aren't really in consensus. That is quite different than saying, who cares what the consensus of scientists say? They claim that science really shows this thing, not that thing. This is crucially different from rejecting the authority of science outright. They actually couldn't live with the dissonance of contradicting science. Even Ken Ham won't just come out with, "Who cares what science has to say? We have a book from God." Science is man-made, and the religious know this, and yet they still feel immense internal pressure to reconcile science with their religious beliefs. They almost never say, "Screw science." Instead, they say real science wouldn't contradict the Bible. Even the religious seek to have their religious beliefs validated by science. We really are living in a time when science is the arbiter of truth. That's the place science holds in our culture. And I'm not complaining. We could do a lot worse. It could be the church or some holy book. My only point is that in our cultural imagination, science is where we get our truth. It deals in objective facts. Everything else, including philosophy, is dealing with something a little less than that. Science can solve every problem, so why would you bother with anything else? There is a place for philosophy in modern life. It feels a little strange to say that, since I'm essentially defending thinking about things. I don't need to make any case defending philosophy if you already believe we should try to understand what exists, what morality is, what we ought to do. Who is looking at our world and concluding that people are too thoughtful? In the words of Bertrand Russell, philosophy is worth contemplating not for the sake of any definite answers to its questions, since no definite answers can, as a rule, be known to be true, but rather for the sake of the questions themselves, because these questions enlarge our conception of what is possible, enrich our imagination, and diminish the dogmatic assurance which closes the mind. Thank you for listening. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll talk to you next time.